I'm Jim Falzerano, and this is Guardian Daily for Wednesday, the 27th of May. Coming up in today's podcast, Conservative leader David Cameron offers his recommendations for reforming Westminster politics.
The select committees, those are the committees that monitor government departments, the members of those committees, and indeed the chairs of those committees, they should be selected by MPs, not selected by the party whips.
And now that North Korea has restated its nuclear ambitions in no uncertain terms, how should the world react?
There are voices in Japan who would like to see them take a more aggressive stance to build more defensive missile systems, for instance, and possibly to start intercepting shipping going to North Korea.
Plus, our image of really big dinosaurs may be all wrong.
If you look at the necks, almost in every case, the necks are actually, even though you won't be able to tell from the outside, the necks are actually an S shape, more like a swan's neck.
But first, a look at the headlines and today's papers with Bill Overton.
North Korea's raised the stakes in its nuclear program by warning it may launch a military strike against South Korea. An official for the North Korean army said that the country would no longer abide by the 50-year armistice it signed with its neighbor after South Korea joined an anti-proliferation exercise which would allow it to search the North's ships. There's more on this coming up in Guardian Daily. The 4-year-old daughter of former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has died a day after she was injured while playing at home in Phoenix, Arizona. Exodus Tyson, who'd been in hospital on life support since Monday, was found with her neck caught in a cable of a treadmill exercise machine. A police investigation ruled the death as a tragic accident. The Home Secretary Jackie Smith faces legal action over allegations that MI5 agents colluded in the torture of a British former civil servant by Bangladeshi intelligence officers. Lawyers for Jamil Rahman are set to file a damages claim, alleging Smith was complicit in assault, unlawful arrest, false imprisonment, and breaches of human rights legislation over his alleged ill treatment while detained in Bangladesh. Rahman says he suffered repeated beatings over 2 years while he is being held. He claims that a pair of MI5 officers were blatantly involved in his ordeal. And patients with persistent back pain are to be offered acupuncture, massages or exercises on the NHS. It's the first time that NICE, the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, has explicitly backed the use of complementary therapies. The watchdog said their research suggests the treatments are extremely beneficial and are cost-effective if doctors stop providing less proven back services, like x-rays. A quick look at the day's papers. There's yet another expenses scandal in The Telegraph, which reports Conservative MP John Greenway claimed £500 of taxpayers' money on pot plants and bushes, as well as 59p for a box of matches. The Sun has more on the other story that's on everyone's minds, the split between Peter Andre and Katie Price. The Express leads with more revelations about the Madeleine McCann case, while The Independent continues with its campaign for parliamentary reform. The back pages, well, they're all about tonight's Champions League final between Manchester United and Barcelona. And there's more news and analysis updated throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
David Cameron has added his suggestions to the long list of proposals for cleaning up British politics in the wake of the MP expenses scandal. Nick Watt, The Guardian's chief political correspondent, evaluates Cameron's strategy for reform.
He's been pretty nimble-footed. He's been using language, emotional intelligence, showing, really reflecting the public anger. Yesterday he came up with this very big speech. We previewed it in The Guardian, which had some pretty interesting ideas for how you could reform the way we do politics in this country. And sort of really two key elements at the heart of what he was saying. The first is to limit the power of the executive. And he's come up with ideas that possibly you could, in the UK, have fixed-term parliaments, which is a bit of a surprise to US voters because they know when their presidential election is. It's every 4 years. We don't know when our elections are. It's when the Prime Minister decides they'll be. But obviously they can be no later than 5 years after the last general election. That is a huge weapon in the Prime Minister's arsenal. And David Cameron says we may need to think about reforming that. So the first thing is limiting the power of the executive. The second thing is boosting the power of backbenchers. Technically, the legislature is meant to be, the legislature is meant to hold the executive to account. But if members of the legislature, that's backbench MPs, are craving government jobs and are controlled by the whips, then they're not going to do a very good job at that. So ideas that David Cameron is coming up with is that the select committees, those are the committees that monitor government departments, the members of those committees, and indeed the chairs of those committees, they should be selected by MPs, not selected by the party whips. And other ideas he's coming up with is saying that at the committee stage of parliamentary bills, that's when MPs, a smaller number of MPs, go through a bill line by line, you should reduce the whipping there. In other words, the government should have less of a role of saying to its MPs, and indeed the opposition saying to its MPs, on this clause you'll vote that way, on that clause you'll vote that way.
How have these reforms been received thus far? Is it beginning a positive response?
Well, the government's responding at two levels. One, there's fury that David Cameron has stolen their thunder. But two, saying, well, actually, we welcome some of these ideas, not least because in the case of Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, I have been talking about many of these ideas for some time. He likes to talk about how he's a bit of a constitutional parliamentary anorak. And people sort of assume that Jack Straw is a bit of a traditionalist because he's opposed to proportional representation. That is changing Britain's first-past-the-post electoral system. He's always been against that. But he is in favour and has always been in favour for some time of reforming the way that Parliament works. He's currently pushing forward a constitutional renewal bill that was meant to be published a few weeks ago but wasn't because of the row over expenses, and it'll now probably be published after the European elections in the middle of next month. And some of the things it'll have in there are what David Cameron's been talking about. One of the things is this idea of reforming the royal prerogative. The royal prerogative basically allows the Prime Minister, in the name of the monarch, to do some pretty extraordinary things: declare war, sign international treaties without asking for Parliament's approval. Well, under the reforms that Gordon Brown was talking about when he became Prime Minister and will be in this bill, are giving Parliament a far greater role in that. But Jack Straw is also talking about other ideas that David Cameron's been talking about, and that's this thing about strengthening select committees. And he's also been talking about introducing something that we don't have in this country, but you do have in the US, which is how Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor of California. That's the recall of MPs who do something wrong. And Jack Straw said he's interested in that.
Nick Watt there, and for more on political reform, go to guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. North Korea has made itself heard loudly and clearly with this week's nuclear missile test. How should the world respond to Pyongyang's defiance? Simon Tisdall is The Guardian's foreign affairs columnist.
Well, there's a variety of opinions on that. I personally incline to the view that there's some kind of power struggle going on in Pyongyang following the illness of Kim Jong-il last year when he's supposed to have had a stroke. He's back at work now, supposedly in charge, but it appears that some of his authority has diminished. He's always been keen, it's thought, to secure a dynastic succession for one of his three sons. That would be a third-generation communist dynastic succession, which would be a sort of unique event. And there may be some in the military who are opposed to that. Another explanation for their behaviour is that they're trying to get the attention of the Obama administration. They want to push the North Korean issue up the agenda. In the past, they've had some success in getting concessions, aid, fuel, and that sort of thing out of the United States and others in return for bad behaviour. So maybe they're trying to do that again. And then the third possibility is that they are just perfecting a nuclear deterrent. Because if you look at the history of North Korea, going back to the Korean War, and before that, the Japanese invasion and so on, they've got reason to want to be secure in their own neighborhood.
Sure. Now, we can understand that the U.S. may be mildly threatened by this, but after all, the United States is a long ways away. What about countries like Japan and South Korea? They must be getting quite nervous by now.
I think they've been quite nervous for quite a long time. Now, the South Koreans have lived with this, of course, for 50 years. And Seoul is within missile and artillery range of North Korea, so they've kind of got used to the problem. The Japanese are more nervous. I mean, of course, the Japanese have the capability to build nuclear weapons themselves, and have eschewed doing that. They instead have chosen to live under the nuclear defensive umbrella provided by the United States. But there are voices in Japan who would like to see them take a more aggressive stance to build more defensive missile systems, for instance, and possibly to start intercepting shipping going to North Korea, which would be a way of tightening the embargo, the sanctions embargo on the country.
All right. Now, talk a little bit about the dilemma that this poses for Obama, because after all, he's renounced the idea of the axis of evil, and he's tried to present a more reasoned face to the North Koreans. And then this, what are his options?
Well, as everyone says, his options appear to be quite limited. I'm not sure that's entirely true. What will determine his options is how determined he is to act and what he wants to achieve. Now, his instinct, as you suggest, is to engage, is to talk, is to unclench the fist. And I think after the UN resolution, the next UN resolution has been passed and some of the dust has settled, if that's what happens, then his instinct may be to try and open up avenues of dialogue with North Korea, to try and say that things really have changed. We don't, we're not interested in regime change, for instance, there are issues of mutual interest which we can discuss, and that building bombs and so on is not the best way to ensure your security. Another option is to toughen the sanctions, not just through the UN but bilaterally, and also, for instance, by interdicting shipping and so on. Another option or variant of options is just to contain and to isolate and hope the regime falls. Or you can try and actively subvert it. You can try and undermine it with covert operations and so on. There are lots of things he can do, but it is extremely problematic.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Still to come, plans to make Manchester United's fans more welcome in Rome.
The idea is to concentrate people there, give them something to do, particularly those who've arrived without tickets, and give them a chance to see the match on a big screen and keep them away from the centre of town, which is where trouble could occur.
Over now to the Hay Festival, where the saga over the Oxford poetry professor involved with a smear campaign against a rival has taken another twist. Claire Armitstead and Charlotte Higgins are there to fill us in.
Well, the Guardian Hay Festival has become the scene of great literary drama. The Ruth Padell controversy, the controversy around the Oxford Professor of Poetry, has moved right here. Ruth Padell, the newly elected Professor of Poetry at the University of Oxford, who's been in post for just 10 days, has resigned. She was due to come to Hay anyway to talk about Darwin, but she took a very unusual move of calling a press conference to explain exactly what had led to her resignation.
I was standing in order to offer the university something I could contribute. I was not in the business of trying to divide it. Yesterday, I learned that opinion within Oxford was bitterly divided. And for that reason, I instantly resigned.
And Charlotte, you'd spoke to her immediately afterwards.
I did indeed, yeah. She was very calm, very quiet, maybe a tiny bit emotional. Ruth Padell, you've acknowledged that you sent an email to two journalists alerting them to allegations that Derek Walcott had sexually harassed students in the past. Do you think now that you were guilty of any wrongdoing?
I think I was guilty of a grave error of judgment. It was a naive and a stupid thing to do. I was concerned about the students' concern, because universities are about students. So that's what I was doing. And I think it was a very foolish and indiscreet thing to do. But I didn't, at the time, believe it was wrong, because all the things I passed to them were in the public domain. They were known for years. It wasn't news. And so in that sense, it wasn't a smear. It was just the cause of the students' concern.
When I spoke to the novelist Jeanette Winterson about your resignation, she called Oxford a sexist little dump, and she told me that she believed that you, in the end, had been forced out by the forces of misogyny, essentially. Do you agree with that?
I don't know about that. I don't know who the people are who were against me, so I can't really comment on that.
When you talk about the fact that Oxford became divided about your position and whether your position was tenable, do you, in fact, feel rather betrayed that people didn't rally round you fully enough to uphold your election?
Lots of people did rally round me. I mean, the people I respected really rallied around me. I have had hundreds of emails from people all over the place. And I think nobody who knows me well could have thought I had anything to do with it. I think in the end, it's about respect. And I certainly have learned who I respect.
So what do you think about all this, Charlotte?
Poor old Ruth Padel. I now feel really sorry for her. I feel like she showed a huge error of judgment in sending an email to journalists, but she didn't really do anything wrong. What do you make of it?
Well, I think that what's extraordinary is how it's brought poetry into this sort of terrible skullduggeries, which I don't suppose it's ever really been in before. I mean, Ruth has had security guard tailing her around the Hay site. She's been delivered to her events by the back door in a car, which usually only happens to American ambassadors.
Yeah, but poetry often is kind of full of nastiness and controversy, isn't it? In that sense, it's nothing new.
But let's be grown up about this and say, actually, what matters now is what happens next. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, we know from Oxford University, they haven't said this formally, but they've indicated that they're going to hold fresh elections after the dust has settled. So we don't need to expect the wheels of Oxford University to grind particularly quickly.
I guess Simon Armitage is hanging around cooling his heels after not getting the laureateship for which he was supposed to be the second in contention. But who else is in the ring now?
Well, Jeanette Winston said to me she just thought Alice Oswald would be a great person to do it. And the novelist Claire Sandbrook said to me she thought Don Paterson would be great. What about you? Who do you think should go for it?
Well, I would actually support Alice Oswald, I think. There you go. Another woman. That would satisfy Jeanette and Jackie Kay.
I completely agree. It should be another woman, because that was the nice thing about having Caroline Duffy as the new poet laureate, wasn't it? And then thinking that Ruth Padel was going to be the Oxford Professor of Poetry. There have never been so many prominent women in poetry at the moment, and there they were at the top of their game in the two most important British positions in poetry.
So the campaign starts here.
For more coverage of The Guardian's Hay on Why Literary Festival, go to guardian.co.uk/hay/books. Elsewhere on the web, Picasso's works find a new lease of life in Antibes. guardian.co.uk/culture. Shell faces a legal fight over human rights and pollution. guardian.co.uk/business. And read the thoughts of U.S. Army soldiers as they prepare to go back to Iraq. guardianweekly.co.uk. In tonight's Champions League final at Rome's Stadio Olimpico, Manchester United fans will once again be venturing into hostile territory. United's last few visits to the Eternal City have not exactly been peaceful affairs. John Hooper, The Guardian's Rome correspondent, reports on Fergie's Field, a place which aims to make the devoted followers of Sir Alex feel more welcome this time.
This is a field which is also a club and party venue on the outskirts of Rome, which has been rented by a British entrepreneur who puts on these parties at all the Champions League finals. He's been doing so for the last 7 years. And the idea is to concentrate people there, give them something to do, particularly those who've arrived without tickets, and give them a chance to see the match on a big screen and keep them away from the centre of town, which is where trouble could occur.
Now tell us why it's so fearful for Man United fans to go to Rome. Give us a little of the history there.
Their side made two visits to Rome in 2007. And on both occasions, some of their supporters were attacked by members of the violent fringe of Roma supporters known as the Ultras. There is quite a knife culture building up in Rome, and football generally here is in the sort of state that British football was in 10 or even 15 years ago. There are frequent episodes of hooliganism at matches, and all of this has built up an edge between the two sides. So I think it's much more on the Roma side than on the Manchester United side. They don't feel that they've got a particular grudge against Roma in the same way.
Have the authorities in Rome made any special provisions for safety and security in advance of the game?
They have indeed. They've put a large number of police, up to 20,000 at the time of the match, onto the, so introduced a ban on alcohol, problem there, though, is how fans will react. And I think one of the worries is just how things will go as a result of the imposition of that ban, which the authorities are saying will be absolutely total. You won't be able to go into any bar after that time and be able to get a drink.
Is Rome excited about this particular fixture?
I think that the Romans generally are taking things in a pretty laid-back fashion. But the Rome fans themselves tend to favour Barcelona. And one of the concerns of those making the security arrangements is that there could be an alliance between the violent fringe of the Roma fans and the violent fringe of the Barcelona fans in order to take on their opposite numbers amongst the Manchester fans.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The largest of all the dinosaurs, the four-legged herbivores known as sauropods, have commonly been represented as having necks that stretched parallel to the ground. But this may be all wrong. Ian Sample, The Guardian science correspondent, reports on a theory that sauropods kept their necks upright.
This is some research from Portsmouth University, and they've said that if you look at like the BBC's Walking with Dinosaurs, or quite often the way dinosaurs are depicted in museums, you have these were the biggest of all the dinosaurs. And usually you see them kind of with their head straight out the front on these long necks, meters and meters long necks, and sort of counterbalanced by the long tail sticking out the other side. And these scientists are saying it's just not the way it is. What they did was they looked at basically a lot of neck x-rays of living vertebrates, and they looked at basically all of the land mammals. And if you look at the necks, almost in every case, the necks are actually, even though you won't be able to tell from the outside, the necks are actually an S shape, more like a swan's neck. And so even in the rabbit, you see this, whereas you'd imagine a rabbit probably doesn't really have much of a neck. What they're saying is that it would be extremely unlikely that the sauropods would be the only type of vertebrate that the Earth has seen that does it differently. So they are just saying, look, it's now for the other scientists who think that the brontosauruses and, well, now called apatosauruses, stick their heads out. It's now for them to prove why they think that's the case.
So that really would have been the exception rather than the rule to, say, dip down for a drink of water, but otherwise fairly erect.
Yeah, well, that's what these guys are saying. But it's funny that if you went to sort of around the 1950s, this was how people thought the dinosaurs looked anyway. So if you talk to paleontologists from back then, they would say, yeah, sure, if a Diplodocus would have its head held high on this sort of S, you know, high straight neck. It was only in the sort of 70s and so that research started coming out, which suggested that they held their necks horizontally. And that was because if you have your head sort of 10 meters, say, above your heart, the amount of blood pressure you have is enormous. I mean, we're talking about seven times our own blood pressure that these animals would have to be able to sustain. And a paper that came out last month said that to do that, your heart would alone weigh 2 tons, and it's quite hard to fit that inside a rib cage. So it just seems unlikely. Having your head lower down means you haven't got to pump the blood high up to a brain.
So this is how science works. You know, we have a prevailing view, then we have a sort of a rebel take on things. What needs to happen now?
Well, in one sense, you could say not much needs to happen in terms of the museums, because a lot of the museums are saying, well, look, we have our dinosaurs, our sauropods with their necks out straight and their heads out straight. These dinosaurs would have had to, even if they did have their necks held high a lot of the time, they still would have had to bring their heads down to drink water and such like. So at some point, their necks would have gone through the horizontal. So the museums can get away with it, even, you know, whoever's right. But all of the people I've spoken to today say one thing: we're never really going to know, because all the sauropods are dead.
So curators can sleep peacefully.
They can indeed.
Thank you very much. This podcast was produced by Peter Sale and Ben Green. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.